I wanted to kind of give you a background on how this all started, how I got in touch with this whole issue of loneliness. Every church that I would go to seemed to have a different story about loneliness. And I was meeting with a church council, and there was a dentist in the church council that said, you know how people are so lonely that their insurance companies actually have to tell them that they can't come and see me more than every 6 months? Because I'm someone that they can talk to. And, you know, I thought you'd have to be awfully lonely to go and see your dentist. And surprisingly, the next day I had an appointment with the dentist, but it wasn't because I was lonely. And so I said to my dentist, you know, do you really find people that come in here because they're lonely? And he goes, you know, we were never taught how to deal with that in dental school. And he says, I actually have a consular friend that I sometimes have people go right straight from my office over to my consular friend's office. Hmm. And then I started picking up themes. A doctor said to me, you know, if the pathology report really showed what people died of, it would not be an organ failure. And he said, I'll give you an example. He said, I did an autopsy, and we put down on the death certificate that she died of an intracranial hemorrhage. And he said, her friends know that she died, that she fell down the basement steps. She fell down basement steps because she had been drinking. She'd been drinking because she was lonely. Then in the inner city, I was talking to people that were running single room occupancy. Well, they were involved with people who lived in the single room occupancy hotels. And they said that how they got into that ministry was two girls that came back from college. And one summer, walked into one of these hotels, knowing that the people in those hotels were so isolated. And the first thing they did was they started knocking on the doors, and people would open the door and then slam it in their faces. They also noticed that the hotel was full of garbage and papers and all sorts of things. And that they decided they were going to be persistent and go every single day and try to visit people and break that isolation. Within a couple weeks, they noticed that the newspapers were beginning to disappear from the floors. They started noticing that the doors were sometimes opening. They noticed that if they would say to them, we will come and visit you on such and such a day, that people were likely to be home. They noticed that the lobby of the hotel cleared out and that people were beginning to congregate in the hotel. And an entire ministry has been started because of the work that these two college girls did that summer. And they have volunteers that come and they talk to people and listen to their stories just to break that isolation. Well, even though I had heard that theme, my whole reaction was one of, yes, we have a homeless society, we have those that are mentally ill, we have seniors, we have all these people who are really lonely. And so I mentioned this in a talk to a congregation, and someone said, well, you know, would you do a discussion, a two-hour discussion on loneliness? And I thought, oh boy, this is a lot. And on what congregations can do about loneliness. Well, I just wanted to share a little bit of what some of the research. This, by the way, is our outline. We're just going to talk a little bit about general loneliness. Loneliness is a state of feeling one is not accepted or does not belong. It implies varying degrees of emotional pain, an empty feeling, a yearning to be with someone, a restlessness. The causes are lack of intimacy with God, lack of intimacy with others, and lack of self-esteem. When I started going through these, I guess I was really surprised. Okay, in the Northwest, I think you find that there are not very many people that go to church. And I would say that that does not mean that people don't have any kind of intimacy with God, but certainly it isn't on a fellowship basis with other Christians. I find that within certain churches, the teachings on trying to teach people to pray, what is centered prayer, how do you teach a congregation to be compassionate and pray with each other? And that I think you notice that even in Midwest churches, where they may have more people that go to church, sometimes it's very, very formal. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's a whole lot of intimacy with God. It's kind of like, this is the way we've been raised, and this is what we will continue to do. This lack of intimacy with others, this is another staggering thing I found, is that 20% of all families move in a year in the United States. And so even though they might have a lot of contact with a lot of people, they don't have time to really build relationships. So this is another area. I'll bring up my favorite topic, which is, of course, television. Many times people, even though they might be able to build up relationships with others, they spend that time in front of the television set. They don't get out to be with each other. And then a lack of self-esteem. And even though a lot of these issues begin very early in life, this is, it's kind of a life kind of theme. And for ourselves, all people have a need to feel loved and valued and a need to feel a sense of social belonging. But the one that is the most important for us is this need to feel loved and valued. You probably, in this one, some people, can feel alone in the crowd. I've heard that saying. But these are just things that they talk about. In any book on loneliness, those seem to be the themes that come out. But the most surprising thing to me was that there was a report in Psychology Today that talked about teenagers. And I'd like to just... It was an article called Seeking a Cure for Loneliness, and that's in Psychology Today, and it's by Ruben Sick. He writes that it has been reported that of all people in our nation, the adolescent has the most problems with loneliness. The teenage years are the time in life when the need for social acceptance is at its peak. Adolescents regard themselves as no longer children, and most are making efforts to become more independent from their families. Ties with peer groups are extremely important, and the resulting pressure can be tremendous. That's probably not telling us a whole lot new, except for the loneliness as being the biggest problem.
You think that's new?
The loneliness for teenagers? Well, one of the things, it probably isn't new, but there is an increasing pressure on kids to drink. And I think, like growing up, even though that was a pressure, it's not quite like what it is today. There's a pressure to be sexually active. Only 31% of the kids in this survey of 273,000 kids said that they didn't, 31% said that they did not feel, well, that they were not sexually active, which I think is a pretty significant theme. And I think we hear a lot about seniors being lonely, which they are, but we also have things that present themselves very readily so that we can see in losses of friends and losses of spouses. Those are easy things to see. And having to move maybe from the family home to something smaller, to an apartment, those are losses we can see. And I think the teenage losses are the things we can't see often. They're not the things that are very often articulated. And, I teach in high school. I can talk to seniors, and I can catch their loneliness. I can talk about their loneliness. I talked to seniors in high school. They wouldn't be caught dead letting anybody know how lonely they are, mm-hmm. or how really hurting they are. And I think that's the reason. It's not that both groups don't have a lot of loneliness, but I think it's the reason that we don't see it. And yet, I should have. I think back on this so often. I teach certified nurse assistants in high school. And the very first time I did that, I remember sending all these, I sent 10 students out. They had to give a bed bath. Oh, that was so scary for them. You know that they came back, and it was their response. They said they liked me, the person I was working with. They liked me. They thought I was okay. Now, what does that tell you that their perception of themselves has been? I mean, that just blew my mind. And I think that was the thing that was really exciting to me, was what a wonderful mix, the elderly and the teenagers. And I think that's one mix we've been missing a little too often. The other thing is, I don't know in your congregations, do many of you have children from other countries? Do you have families that have come from other countries?
Sure.
Do you? Mm-hmm. And fairly.
Philippines and Vietnam.
Vietnamese. Okay.
Chinese and stuff.
Okay. When I was teaching high school, some of my students had been in this country maybe 8 years at the most. And when I was beginning to teach the class to teach them to become certified nurse assistants, I would go around the class and I would say, now some of you have come from other cultures. How does your culture teach the elderly? And it never failed to move me how other cultures, what a reverence that other cultures have for the elderly. And at the end of one of these sessions, I said to the children, the students that had come from overseas, I said to them, you have so much to teach us in America. And one boy said, I've been in this country 8 years and no one has ever told me I had anything to teach any American. And he said that with an awful lot of, you know, and I thought, well, that's probably true. And he doesn't even realize how much he had to teach. So then I was beginning to get more and more calls from pastors telling me stories about teenagers and violence and the, you know, what they were up against. And so I called Dick Hardell. If any of you know Dick Hardell, his heart has long been with youth. And he showed me some materials. He told me to send for some materials, which I did right away. And this is the first time that I have used it with a group like this. I've used it with parish nurses to give them ideas of what they can use in their congregation. But I would like to use this with you today. And I would like your opinions when we get all finished. What I'm going to do is to pass out a checklist, and it's on assets. And it says, what's your perception? Thinking of the typical youth you know, mark those assets about which you are most pleased or troubled. So I want you really to think of one teen that you know, be it your own or some other teen that you know. And go down and figure out. Now, my husband and I did this with our own children to see what we could discover. And we discovered a lot of things that we would have changed if we had known about assets then. I mean, our children are in their mid and late 20s, so.
You're talking about assets.
Assets. And this will explain the assets. There are 30 possible assets that they find that a teenager should have. And the more assets they have.
Are you talking about physical assets, or are you talking about?
Well, it's both internal and external assets, and it lists all the assets, so you can read them and then see whether or not the teen that you know has that asset. So, I don't know if you need the lights. Do you need the lights? I marked when they copied these things, yeah, they're all the same. They left off the internal assets, so there are external assets and internal assets. So if you've got one that isn't marked, halfway down here is the beginning of the internal assets. Okay, so this is where the internal assets begin. So think of one, so these are, take a youth that you know and mark them whether or not they have assets. Their internal assets. Let me see, are there some? Internal ones halfway in. Here's a pen. Okay. Maybe I should. I see some of you knew it squinting.
Yes, I really should turn on the light.
Yeah. Okay. And if you just kind of turn to your neighbor and maybe just share with them some things that you noticed in these assets that you might, you know, have you ever thought about this before, that people need these assets? And we're going to see a short video on this, but you could just pick one partner and just maybe just share something that you see in these assets.
To develop them so that they would want to be involved in the
inspiring
Oh, I can read it. I have to labor. This is close. 2015, better get in here. I need more light.
I want to
some courses. I was busy going to the military. And I was making decisions. I weren't asking any questions of somebody else. So I have trouble following the guy. I can't say you screwed up yet. Although he does some strange things in my eyes.
Well, I guess it's providing a little bit of a
I'm going to stop the discussion, but we may come back to it a little later. So how do we give kids these assets?
It's modeling and it's family, I think, is the bulk of it. It's just modeling appropriate behavior and allowing the kids to be kids. And where this says 16 out of 30 American youths have these character traits, if you only got a one-parent household and mom's working all the time and you're a latchkey kid, you're not going to have some of these opportunities as regularly as somebody else.
And what happens to society as the tipping factor takes over, where there are fewer two-parent families, where there are there's more unstructured time for kids? What else needs to happen? Because it's going to affect your kids. Even if you're a two-parent family and you're doing stuff right, the fact that there are a whole lot of other kids out there where this isn't happening, what else needs to be happening?
That's where that peer pressure comes in.
So how, yeah.
Well, I think that part of it is that we need to spend time with them and treat them as real individuals, and take the time, because I think some of the kids that I'm thinking of don't have that support from their families.
So who can provide it?
Well, I think that we as individuals can provide it. I think that, other families can provide that, maybe some of their friends' families, and hopefully the church as a community can start to provide that.
Okay, I want to show you. I want to show you a video that goes along with this building assets in youth, and that's the name of this. It's called Building Assets in Youth, and you'll probably want to turn around over there.
Yeah,
unless you don't want to. Well.
Yeah, I was a little worried.
the tendency for people to resort to violence to solve problems.
Big concern, I think, is jobs and security for them.
I'm concerned about depression and eating disorders and chemical dependency.
There are a lot of things about youth are rooted from the home.
We are going at such a rush and hectic pace that we might not be taking time for the things that they really need in their formative years.
We see our youth having one problem after another, and we don't know how to help. A lot of the things we try don't seem to make any difference.
Kids, definitely. Are at a point where they don't know if anyone really appreciates their role in the world or the role in school.
So much of what I do professionally and my colleagues do professionally has been and will continue to be putting our fingers and toes in the day.
I don't think our culture values young people that much.
What will it take to create a hopeful future for our young people? How can we do a better job of raising the young? What can we do that will make a difference? New research is revealing a powerful new approach that can work in our families, our schools, our communities, and our congregations.
I think we need a new approach, an approach that is more positive, one that we now call positive youth development, in which we seek to understand what are the necessary building blocks of human development? What are the experiences? What are the opportunities that every young person needs in order to grow up in a healthy way? And then how can we begin to mobilize communities to be sure that all of these good things are in every young person's life?
Always said, well, if they steal, we'll do something then, rather than trying to encourage the positive things.
In police work, we focus on, and we see an awful lot of the negatives in our society. We see people at their worst. They are victims, they are perpetrators of crime, they are sick, they are injured, they are lost. And much of what we do has to do with managing those crises in people's lives.
A lot of times it's because we don't know what we really want. We don't know how to voice, how to say the things that we want.
Search Institute has used in-depth surveys to listen to hundreds of thousands of youth across the United States. This research has shown that there are specific, practical things that each of us can do that will make a positive difference in the lives of youth in our communities.
In the last few years, Search Institute has developed a concept called developmental assets. And we name 30 of these assets or building blocks based on lots of research that every young person needs to have in their life. These fall into six categories. Three of those have to do with external assets. Those are things in young people's environments, in their homes and schools, neighborhoods, congregations. And it has to do with how well those environments support and nurture young people, how well they set boundaries and provide mechanisms of control, and how well they involve them in structured time use, where they are involved with caring and principled adults who help lead them in the development of these assets. And then some of the assets we call internal assets. Those have to do with the attitudes and values and competencies that we really need to put inside the head and the heart of every child and teenager in our community. Altogether, there are 30 of these developmental assets that we work with. First of all, let's talk about how many of the 30 assets American kids have. Again, we ought to be sure that every child and teenager has at least 20. Additive. They're cumulative. The more a young person has, the better. But we find in these 600 communities, 300,000 young people studied to date, that the average young person has only 16. So the average young person between grades 6 and 12 doesn't have 25 of the assets, doesn't have 20. but has only 16.
This depletion of assets can be seen in each of the hundreds of communities Search Institute has studied. While every community is unique, assets are too few in all communities, regardless of size, region, or income level. These assets are extremely powerful. They're additive. The more, the better. To illustrate that, Search Institute has grouped these many hundreds of thousands of young people into four categories. Some young people have only 10 or fewer of the assets. Some have 11 to 20. Some have 21 to 25. And some have 26 to 30. Notice the percentage of young people that are at risk in the area of alcohol use. Look at how high that percentage is in the group on the left that has only 0 to 10 assets. 46% of those young people in our communities are at risk in the alcohol area. But then look at the dramatic drop for those who have 11 to 20, the further drop for those who have 21 to 25, and the very small number who have 26 to 30 assets. The same kind of trend could be demonstrated in the area of early sexual expression, in school failure, in depression and attempted suicide, in violence and antisocial behavior. In short, youth who have more assets are much less likely to get involved in all the problem behaviors we worry about.
But it isn't only that the more assets a young person has, the less at-risk behavior they engage in. We also know that as the assets increase, school success increases, and we know that as the assets increase, the caring behaviors of our young people increases. They begin to volunteer more. They are more engaged in their communities and making a difference for others. Rebuilding the asset base in communities has to become our top priority. And every community can do this work. It isn't easy to rebuild these positive things, but it can be done. There are three steps I want to just quickly suggest. The first thing a community has to do is to mobilize all of its citizens to be on the team, to get every citizen in a community to know that they are an asset builder.
We cannot do it alone as a school. The city cannot do it alone. The religious community cannot do it alone. But we are totally convinced that together, as the African proverb goes, if the whole village will join the journey, we will succeed.
We're going to marshal the creative resources of the community, the what's already there in the community.
Community itself has said, we don't have the resources to do it alone. And we as a church certainly don't have the resources to do it alone. But somehow, cooperatively, we can accomplish a lot more.
Now the focus is on including everyone, educators, business people, parents, the whole community, in focusing on children.
Then a community needs a plan.
We have challenged our staff and our community. How do we go about building these assets? And so every teacher, every faculty member in our school district is working on a plan presently to increase the assets from the average of 16 to where our goal is 26, because we know if we get to 26, the kids won't be in trouble.
And then as part of the plan, what we have to do is to build asset-promoting strength in our families, in our schools, in religious institutions, in neighborhoods, in the places teenagers work. And the third thing a community needs to do is to coordinate this effort of building assets. Families and schools and neighborhoods and religious institutions, youth-serving organizations, need to work hand in hand.
The whole issue is these assets will build character in students. And if everyone is involved in doing that, kids will get the same message from everybody. They will get the same message from the teacher. They will get the same message from the policeman. They will get the same message from their neighbor. So everyone is involved in the whole idea.
This isn't going to be a six-month deal. This isn't going to be a hokey one-year shot. I think we have marshaled, through the leadership and the community, the kind of sustained effort that it's going to take to really make a difference over a long period of time.
I feel a real good that communities, elders, parents are really looking towards us, and they're helping us because it makes me feel important, and then I would want to succeed.
I think it's a good idea the community be involved because you feel all alone when you're single parent, and once you open up, it makes you feel like, wow, you know, I've done it. You know, I have these people helping me.
They actually want me here to succeed. They're taking their time out for me. And I think that's a really important factor as goes back to support and encouragement.
I believe that the community that mobilizes this energy will see profound consequences in the health and vitality of its young people. And by promoting and building these assets, your community will make major strides in raising the kinds of caring and responsible and wise young people this country desperately needs.
I think I've got that. Oh, maybe I don't have that phone number, but I'll get it.
Does this sound a little ambitious?
Well, I'll tell you something, that the school district where I teach called us, sent a letter to all of the, I don't even know how large is Beaverton. I don't even know what the population, half million people, sent a letter to every clergy person in our area and asked them if they would come and talk about what the church needs to know about the school system. And I go to a Catholic Lutheran church, and I thought it was real interesting that probably about 6 months ago, someone had told me this. In fact, Dick Hardell just backed it up. I said, you know, I heard that if people in your congregation can be encouraged to learn the names of the children, that cuts down on risk behavior of children, which I think is very, very interesting, and I think very important. Well, I ran that by Dick Hardell, and he said, oh yeah, that's really true. And then he said, in fact, when kids in my church start getting to confirmation age, I have a picture of the kid, a little biographical sketch, and he said, as some of my older people come into the congregation on a Sunday morning, I'll pass them a picture and a biographical sketch, and I'll say, when Susie comes into church this morning, say good morning to her and ask her how she is, how things are. And he said, she won't even hear my sermon. What's going on in her mind is, why did they say good morning to me? How come they knew my name, and why did they care about me? And he said that has a profound effect on congregations. Well, I happen to have said that in front of the priest in my church, and I am absolutely astounded at the things that have been happening in my congregation since that time. And almost every Sunday he'll say, I'm so glad you told me that. People have learned the names of the children. Two of the children were baptized about 4 weeks ago, and they ask that every person in the congregation write a prayer for these children using their names. That what we would wish for them in their lives, what we would ask that God would do for them in their lives. And he gave these children the task. He said that they also need a task for the congregation, and he gave them the task, with the help of some adults, that they would make a book of every child in the congregation so that there would be a picture and who the child is and when their birthday is and all this kind of stuff. Well, I thought it was significant that out of the 20 people that came to the school district's information session, four of them were from my church. three of them were Catholic, and I was the only Lutheran. And I was the only Lutheran from the area that showed up. But I thought it was significant that the school district has felt that this is important. Part of the discussion was, where can we partnership? What kind of partnership do we need to be forming? And you know, in a school district, they can, with 95% accuracy, tell you which kids are going to end up in prison by the end of second grade. So what needs to be happening between churches and schools to alleviate that problem? Because the schools, I know, cannot solve all of the problems. The parents aren't solving a lot of the problems. And you do need the involvement of everyone. Let's see, I wanted to just share with you some of the other things that that are going on. There is one church in Northeast Portland that is serving, they had what they called a Recovery of Hope program during the summer. And what it was, they are stationed right where all of the drug, there's a great deal of drug trafficking going on in that neighborhood. So what they did was they had a tent and they had counselors from all over come in and volunteer their time. And what they did was they just started counseling with parents and drug pushers, anyone else, anyone they could pull in off the streets, just started talking with them. And the drug trafficking decreased by a lot. And they got to know a lot of the parents in the neighborhood that were having drug problems. And they did build up an AA and NA group in that church. Well, in the afternoons when school was out, that was in summer. In the afternoons, though, the kids would come by because they'd smell popcorn. And so they'd come in and they'd give them pop and popcorn. And when they took the tent down, there were some children standing there and said, "Are you going to leave us? Are you going to leave us too?" And the pastor was really gripped by these children. And he said that one little boy sat in the back of the church and he just relaxed his body and he said, "This is the only place that I know of that I am safe." He said, "I am not safe at home, I am not safe in the street, and I am not safe at school, but here I am safe." So that pastor, with only one person in his congregation backing him up, started something called Safe Haven. He now has 116 children that are enrolled in this program. And I want to tell you that I've worked in third world countries, and the first day I went down to see where he has these children, it was like I was back in a third world country. Just a little, he has two very tiny rooms, probably, you know, just like from here to the wall there, where somehow they managed to carry on a program. And one day, one of the teachers came out in the parking lot, and she saw a little girl running and running and running, saying, just saying, "No, no, 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 no." The teacher stopped her and said, "What are you doing?" She says, "Oh, I'm being mommy." So you know that these children really, really need a lot. And I think that as a church community, as a school community, we need to be looking at ways to do something for these children that nobody really cares about. And I think, you know, we have to find ways of doing it. And I'll tell you that the best $5 you ever spend will be getting this book, What Kids Need to Succeed, which just goes right along with the assets. And what it does is it tells, okay, let me just give you, asset number 20 has to do with homework. Kids regularly spend time doing homework. They do 6 or more hours of homework a week. It says 24% of the youth we surveyed have this asset in their lives. So what it does is it gives 6 suggestions for what parents can do. It gives 4 suggestions as to what the school can do. It gives 4 suggestions for what the community can do and 3 suggestions as to what the church can do. So it has a lot of excellent information in here.
Who's it by?
This one is, this is Peter Benson, the one you saw from Search Institute. See, Peter Benson, Judy Galbraith, and Pamela Espeland. And it's based on a nationwide survey of over 270,000 young people in 600 communities. Let's see, it's, if you look for it in a bookstore, it's under parenting/education. And I think there is a phone number of what? Well, I'm looking for that. Any reaction to these materials? Does it give you a different perspective, or is this something that most of you knew about?
Very positive. My only concern is the word control. Uh-huh. You just mentioned that they're all going around saying, no, I'm playing mommy. Uh-huh. For many parents, they will say, I have lost control over my children. Mm-hmm. I cannot manipulate them. I mean, control can imply something very negative, and I guess I wish you would say something about setting boundaries rather than control, because I think that's what they're referring to rather than...
Yeah. Well, yeah, in fact, there's that whole section on boundaries and under external assets.
Well, it says control. That's what I mean. I wish you'd say boundaries instead of control.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because see, in the book, it does say boundaries.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I'm glad, because see, I didn't notice that, because I've just gone by this. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even look at that it said that. Yeah, but it does say boundaries. Any other reactions to this?
There's someone in Minneapolis where they tried, where they have organized, and I suspect that's who the superintendent and the police officer
probably
were,
yeah,
from St. Louis Park, and they have consciously, as a community, said that they will focus on youth. And so they have things like seniors waiting for buses with the kids, mm-hmm, or being there when they come home from school and things like that. Just real kind, sensible village stuff where you're, mm-hmm, all raising the children together.
Right.
So it's working.
Well, this last week before I came here, I had the most unusual, and I'm throwing this out as an idea. I had the most unusual celebration. I don't think I've ever gone to a celebration like this. It was an African American mother who had been married to a pastor and was a victim of domestic violence. So left her home, came to Portland, joined a church, really looked around for a place that where she felt that the church was going to be supportive of her children. And what this was, now this happened, goodness, did she say 20 years ago, because her daughter was 32. What this was a celebration of her daughter's final graduation from college with a degree in mechanical engineering. And what she did was she invited all the people that had been supportive. She says, we know it takes more than just a family to raise a child. And she invited all those people that have been part of this raising of her daughter. So she even had the woman, the neighbor woman who had sat and listened to many hours of anguish when the daughter couldn't share with her mother. And she said there were some times when she was real jealous of that, and yet she knew within herself that her daughter needed that. And the people who could not be at this gathering, she asked them to send tapes to share with her daughter. And she rented a banquet hall in a hotel, not in a hotel, in a restaurant. And around the room, she must have spent hours, she put up, I think, everything from first grade papers to letters of recognition, to anything that daughter could have been proud of. And then she asked an older brother to come, and he told about growing up with her, and it was just, he teased her a little bit about taking that long to get through college, and there were a lot of little jokes about that. The mother had a college roommate come, someone from the another woman who had graduated with her degree in mechanical engineering. It was the most wonderful thing. And then the mother sang. I mean, it was just a real, you know, and it was a very affirming time for this daughter. I mean, it couldn't have, at first she walked in, she looked so embarrassed. And she said, this is supposed to be a surprise, but my mom had to tell me in order to get me to come. But it really is a good idea to celebrate the village, really, is what it was. So I thought that was wonderful. Any other things that you might want to say?
One thing that's bothering me that I lend myself to the thinking, and it makes a lot of sense. But I'm thinking of the staff that I live with day after day, and I'm thinking of 50, 60 families. And the problem, there's a basic problem, and it's the problem in the home. And it's the materialism of the home. The families have dedicated themselves to a certain level of materialism. And that takes mostly two people working. Who is taking care of those people who are 5 years, 3 years old? Who is raising those kids? And it's not the parents. Mm-hmm. It's not the parents. We have said somebody else is going to give that block of time to getting my children through those most critical years. Someone else, not the parents. Now, we have written off, by and large, I'm thinking my own staff that is bothering me, and we talked about this. How do these people give the block of time necessary to instill in these young people the qualities that we're groping for here? We have delegated the development of these assets to someone else who may or may not even be interested. And it's basically because we have committed ourselves to a materialism where we're going to have two or three cars, we're going to have all the fun things, and we taught those kids the same principles that parents have, and it's based on materialism, and that is not what the church needs to be dealing with. And how they need to, in a sense, what I'm saying is the church needs to be talking to parents as to what's number one priority, rather than, secondly, of course, we need to be dealing with the children.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I'd hope that to come here and find out what could we be doing in our church to help me communicate with these young people. And the more we talked, the more it seemed to me we've got to be telling the parents, raise your children as number one priority instead of number two or three priority. Sorry about
well,
that.
Well, no, I agree with you. It isn't that I don't agree with you. I think that there are, I mean, when you look at violence in our society, I mean, what does that come? A lot of that comes from the television. And that is run by corporations that have products to sell. So we just get we have a proliferation of violence because that's what people want to watch, I mean, to a certain extent. And I think it needs to be a serious discussion in any congregation. And I think materialism, I mean, I've been out of this country more than I've been in it, and it appalls me because I don't see that people here really see what materialism is doing to this culture. And it's, you know, it's like society run amok. And I think that the hope comes from the church. And I think the church has to continue to talk about this. And I think even in this, you know, what are the roadblocks? Spending two or more hours a day alone, parents need to be considering. There are a lot of kids that are alone every day. These are the roadblocks to what they found when they did these 270,000 students. They found that these were going to be the roadblocks to any success. I mean, this is what is primarily found. Spending two or more hours a day alone, putting a lot of emphasis on selfish values. And the first thing I could think of was the number of high school kids, they immediately go to the mall after school. Watching more than 3 hours of TV a day, going to parties where friends will be drinking alcohol, feeling stress or pressure most of the time. And a lot of that comes from what is going on in the home. Being physically abused by an adult, being sexually abused, having a parent who has a problem with alcohol or other drugs, feeling socially isolated from people who provide care, support, and understanding, having a lot of close friends who often get into trouble. And you know, I think, this isn't a panacea at all, but one of the things in your congregation, this building Assets in Youth, having youth talk about this, having parents talk about it, having staff talk about it, and that's where part of the planning together, and one would hopefully, you would hope that part of the discussion would come out then as far as what are the parental duties here. And I think a lot of that comes through in this book on what kids need to succeed. So I think
one of the magnificent lady, she's a counselor that I have had the opportunity to watch work. Her energies are really, to a considerable degree, directed just this direction as she reaches out to the children, but she exhausts her energies with her profession, and she's not home with her own kids. I mean, it's a disaster when I shouldn't say that, because I don't really know that. Mm-hmm. But I almost wept at one meeting. And she's a great leader, and I affirm that over and over again. But I also know this, where her kids are in the daytime, and they're not with mom. Mm-hmm.
Are they with dad?
I'm sorry?
Are they with dad? Does he stay home then?
I'm sorry, I can't hear. My hearing isn't 100%.
Are they with the dad?
Oh, to some extent, but not much. Oh, no, they're committed to...
babysitter.
They're committed, and they have, I'm sorry, it's either three or four children. But I know the two youngest ones are somewhere else with professional, and they're in good care. Hey, I'm mm-hmm. sure of that. Mm-hmm. But that's not mom either, and it's not dad, because they have committed their lives economically mm-hmm. and socially. They've committed themselves a different route. The number one priority in that family is not those kids.
Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't have them.
And I don't know how we deal with that, because our community, our culture, is telling us that that's the way we should be dealing with our families.
But maybe that's exactly the reason we need to keep talking about it and yes. coming up with new awarenesses and not be afraid to talk about the issue. And I think a lot of churches have given up talking about the issue. And I don't think that that's... In fact, I want to close with this thing on loneliness. This is Al Rogness quoting Thomas Wolfe from Thomas Wolfe's essay on God's Lonely Man and Woman. Says, what Christ is saying always, what he never swerves from saying, what he says 1,000 times and in 1,000 different ways, but always with a central unity of belief, is this: I am my God's son, and you are my brothers and sisters, and the unity that binds us all together, that makes this earth...